The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. First of all, sorry for being late. We are in the era of GPS, so at the moment it doesn't work. The driver doesn't know what to do. But here we are. Dear friends, I'll try now to do something which seems almost impossible. I'll try to show you what is in common between John Lennon and the leaders of Al-Qaeda. And, well, it's very easy to say what is different. One is great musician, great pacifist, person who loved life, loved individuals, loved human rights. And the other awful terrorists for whom people's life is nothing, and who believe that everybody who doesn't share their faith is infidel. But John Lennon, in his great song, Imagine, dreamt about the world where there are no nations, no religion, no borders, nothing to die for. He believed strongly that, and this belief was shared by, and is shared by millions and millions, that in order to really enjoy happy life, in order to be free, there should be no religion and no nation, no identity, nothing to die for. On the other hand, these awful terrorists from Al-Qaeda, and they can quote one after the other, say again and again that we will win you in the West because we love death and you love life. For them, the freedom, love to life, love to respect to human rights is the enemy. And in order to reach the world of their dream, the real paradise, they have to destroy freedom. So for both of them, though one of them is our hero, our ideal, the person whom we deeply respect and admire, and for those awful terrorists, identity and freedom are on the different sides of barricades. And both of them, in fact, are saying that the person has to embrace or universal values or particular values. You cannot have both. I have to say that I first met with this problem or encountered this challenge when I was in Moscow, an official spokesman of two movements, Soviet Jewry movement and human rights movement of the Soviet Union. I was, together with Jewish activists in Soviet Union and abroad, like Kanye and Joe Smakler, fighting for the rights of Jews to live as Jews and to go to Israel. And I was, together with Andrei Sakharov and others, establishing Helsinki Group, fighting for the rights of people to express their feelings, to read what they want to read, to say what they want to say. And then I was criticized, sometimes on both sides, from some of my Israeli friends, that really if you are real Jewish activist, you cannot really work for human rights in abstract. You have to choose particular. You have to choose your own agenda, Jewish agenda. On the other hand, I heard not rather often from some of my colleagues who believed in the struggle for human rights, were saying, how can you be a nationalist if you really believe in human rights? As one of my colleagues in Helsinki Group told me, I can support nationalists only when they are in prison. Because when they win, they become a problem. They want to insist only on their rights for the sake of the others. I have to say, I never had this problem. For me, it was always very natural connection between freedom and identity. And I'll tell you why. Because I was extremely lucky. As a loyal Soviet citizen, I was deprived of both, of freedom and of identity. And I discovered them both at the same time. Because, well, in Soviet Union, of course, loyal Soviet Jew, as I was, knew nothing about our history, about our religion, about our tradition, about the state of Israel. Even about Holocaust, we knew nothing. We were not supposed to know anything. We knew that we are Jews only because there is anti-Semitism. So the only Jewish thing in my life was anti-Semitism. On the other hand, we were deprived of freedom, and we knew very well that that you live in a very uncomfortable situation of constant doublethink. There are things which you can say and which you cannot say. There are books which you cannot read. When you go to participate in elections, you know in advance for whom you have to vote. And if there is some truth about that regime, you can say it only in your family or among close circle of friends. And then after Six-Day War, we discovered that there is a state which is fighting not only for its right to exist, but also for your dignity. A lot changed after Six-Day War. And we wanted to understand what this mystical connection between us and that state is. And we started learning and learning in the underground about our history. And suddenly I discovered there is a great history of exodus of thousands of years ago, which continues until now. And there is great, powerful force of solidarity of Jewish people. And there is the state of Israel. And you know, and when I discovered my identity, suddenly I had enough strength to speak freely my mind. And that's how I discovered my freedom. And that's why the things came to me together. But then, when I was in prison, I understood this connection even deeper. Because in prison, in fact, what was the choice that you were facing? KGB was explaining you very simply. You will be killed if you will not cooperate with us. If you will not say publicly that we are right and you are wrong, you'll be killed. And they were saying you are such a wonderful person. They were giving me many, many compliments. And you are so young, and you have a beautiful wife waiting for you in Israel. You want that all this will be destroyed? You want to lose your life? What for? Say that we are right and you are wrong. And I had to find arguments why not to agree with their logics. And I was isolated from all the world. I had to find these arguments for myself in my head. And you're looking for logical reasons why not to cooperate with KGB. And of course there are a number of logical reasons, but you understand very quickly that logic is not a moral instrument. Their logic is at least as powerful as your logic, if your aim is physical survival. If your aim is how to survive by all means, their logic is much stronger. But then, if you put yourself in a much bigger context than your immediate physical survival, if you put yourself in the context of this unique history, of this unique struggle between good and evil, the context of your people all over the world fighting for you, the people like John Canyon, there were hundreds and hundreds, as my accomplices mentioned in these materials of KGB, they were interrogating me every day, about this person, that person, all these people who were fighting all over the world. And it's such a big struggle. And you understand that you want to continue to belong to this history. You understand that every word of yours, every step of yours, what you're doing here in the prison, maybe is even more important than every word which was before your arrest. After all, what changed? They took you physically from one house in Moscow and moved to the KGB prison, which is only 2 miles from there. So they moved you 2 miles. But in terms of big, historic, unique struggle of our people, it's nothing. To the contrary, you now are playing an even more important role. And when you're putting you in this context, and you want that in this struggle, you, your wife, your friends, your country will be strong and will win, you understand that you should not cooperate. Because you you feel it very strongly that there are things which are more important than physical life. There are things worth dying for. You want to leave these things. But if you are not ready to die for these things, then you are not cannot defend them. So it was clear that identity is my shield in this attempt of KGB to destroy my inner freedom. But another thing which I discovered was, what about identities of the other people? Here there are many different political prisoners, Ukrainian nationals and Russian monarchies and Catholics from Lithuania and many, many other types of political prisoners. And you have to decide who of them is your ally. And KGB does everything that everybody suspects everybody. You can never know who of them is informer. They try to convince you that you are absolutely alone in this world. You can rely only on yourself, not on anybody else. They try to destroy any connection, any solidarity between two prisoners. And you find out very quickly that the only criteria which you have is that those who have strong identities, it's most probable that they will not be informers. Because exactly as I have the things for which I'm ready to die, but not to cooperate with KGB, they also have their values, their identity, for which they are ready to die, but not to cooperate with KGB. In fact, one of my closest, maybe the closest friend in prison was Orthodox Christian. Young activist of Orthodox Christian movement who was arrested at the age of 20, spent many years fighting for his right to have New Testament and, in the prison and to continue being Christian in prison, what was rather difficult. And I have to say that when he came to prison, he brought with himself a lot of primitive anti-Semitic prejudices. Simply he never was working with the Jews, but from that group from which he came, there were many prejudices. But in the context of our mutual life, during our mutual life, first in prison, first of all, he and another Catholic activist and Pentecostals with whom I was sharing cells, they all understand that we all want to live in a society where people are not punished for their views. So we want to live in freedom. But also we understand that our main individual, each of us, has one shield against KGB. It's our identity. And I am interested that he will not give up on his identity, and he is interested that I will not give up on my identity, because we are interested to struggle together against KGB. And that's how you find out that, in fact, identity, if it is framed with democracy, if our identities are linked through our desire to live in a free society, that is our powerful weapon against KGB. And this simple truth, that identity and freedom have to go together, that identity without freedom can become fundamentalist, and freedom without identity can become weak and decadent, because there is nothing to die for. And that's why they have to be together in this struggle against the totalitarian regime was absolutely obvious for us. And no doubt that this union was very powerful in destroying the Soviet Empire. Unfortunately, many years after, when we look at our world, we see how these two phenomena are fighting one against the other. How people in the free world see in the identities danger. And how many people with strong identities see in freedom danger for themselves. If you look on the world history, this idea of bringing happiness to the world by erasing identities was very popular. It was coming one after year, century after century in many dreams, in many utopias. In our modern life, two biggest attacks on identity were Marxist attack and the modern post-nationalism and multiculturalism. If you look at the Marxist-Leninist attack, Marx came with idea of communism, of paradise for all the people through class struggle, which in the end has to bring us to the situation where there are no classes, no nations, no religions, nothing to die for. And Karl Marx was very consistent in this idea, explaining again and again that religions, after all, is opium for the people, and it's imagined thing which capitalists use to unite people and to exploit them. At the same time, he did recognize that some of the nations at this moment are needed for the future progress, some are not. So the fact that nations are erased, after all, is a positive thing. Well, he was building theory. Then came Lenin and then Stalin and started implementing this theory. And because the nature of the people was resisting to this erasing of the identities, so they had to start from killing small groups and then big groups and the bigger groups, millions and tens of millions. Well, estimations of historians today are from 50 to 60 millions of the citizens of the former Soviet Union were killed, destroyed, exiled, starved to death in order to erase identities. And suddenly, at one moment, for a few years, this policy stopped. When it stopped? When Hitler deceived Stalin, and in spite of the agreement which they had about sharing the world, the lands of the Europe, Hitler attacked Stalin. And the big battle between Nazi Germany and Soviet Union started. It took Stalin a few days to change all his rhetorics, to bring back from Siberia those Christian leaders who were not yet killed, and through them to start to rebuild religious institutions, to restore the institutions of respect to Russian history, to Russian tsars, to establish medals in the name of great Russian fighters, to change the hymnon from the hymnon which was international, solidarity of all the working people of the world, he changed it into the hymnon about great Russia which united all these people. Why? Because Stalin understood very well that if you want people to be ready to die for, they cannot die. They're not ready to sacrifice their life for some abstract ideal, abstract picture of communism, of happiness for everybody, some abstract universal value. They will die for their house, for their home, for their religion, for their nation, defending their history and their identity. So it was interesting that regime, which was based on the idea of destroying identities and which put such an effort and killed so many people in order to erase identities, immediately started mobilizing all these identities, national and religious, in order to save the country in the time of the war. Well, and of course, after the war, he continued the same policy which was before. If you'll take the second big assault on identity, it started after the Second World War. And it was not led by these fanatics. In fact, it was led by people who deeply believed in human rights, who deeply believed in liberty, who deeply believed in peace. And the idea was that now that we had such two awful wars in Europe, the first and the second, we have to learn from them. And the main conclusion was that it is because of this nationalism, because of this fanatism, that we had these wars. So let us try to build the world which overcomes these particular identities and which unites under the banner of human rights and liberty. And in fact, that was the idea of United Nations. And it's not accidental that the first document of United Nations was the Charter of Human Rights, proclaiming the fundamental rights of all the people. And that was the idea of United Europe. But what happened at the same time, unfortunately, was that it was decided that in order to have a peace, that the peace is the main aim. War is evil. Identities bring us to war. It means that identities are evil. So we have to decrease them. And they started, and many of liberal thinkers started working, not through politics, but mainly through cultural institutions, through universities, but then also influencing on the politicians, to decrease the importance of the identity. And look what happened in Europe. And I am simply jumping now to our days. Those who want to know more details how it was developing in the modern history can read about it in my book. But look what happens today with Europe. Europe is, well, if you'll take only Western Europe, it's also hundreds of millions, more than 300 million people. One of the oldest civilizations of freedom. People who are so deeply devoted to freedom and democracy, who proved that they were ready to fight when it was necessary for their freedom. And now they are in panic. Why? There are 15 million Muslims. Among these Muslims, among these 15 million, a small group of fundamentalists who are fighting against the rules of democracy. And Europe is defenseless. And there is one after another, books and articles and speeches, how weak Europe is in meeting this challenge. Why? I don't go now to statistics again. You can read all this in my book and in many others to which I refer. But the interesting question is, why suddenly Europe feels itself so not protected? You know why? Because Europe is a big community of people who are devoted to democracy, but who stopped believing in their identity. Nationalism is a bad word in most of the countries. Religion, look on Sundays, your churches are full. Look, all the churches in Europe are empty. It is believed that the less we feel ourselves connected to our national history, the more is the chance that there will be peace in Europe. And then when there comes a small group of people who has no obligation to democracy, and it has no obligation because nobody demanded it from them. As a part of this multicultural idea, you are not supposed to demand from these people anything. They have to belong to their culture. They are respected to their culture. But they are not. They have absolutely no obligation towards democracy or free world, but they have very strong identity. And you find out that when you have these two groups of people, one big group with belief in freedom, but without any identity, and the other is with very strong identity, but without any respect to democracy, society is defenseless. It cannot defend itself. As one of the leading journalists in Europe and ask why you are not fighting back. How it can be that in the mosques in London and Paris there are sermons against freedom and democracy and the governments are financing them. How it is that you are afraid even to uncover, to have a statistics how many honored killings are happening this day in Europe and you are afraid to touch it. And he said frankly, he said, you know, we all our life we learned how to enjoy freedom. We never learned how to defend freedom. Because we believed that the ideal world is the one in which there is nothing to die for. And, well, from this point, I have to say, America, United States of America, is in a much better situation. And, I would say, on many campuses in America, and the many universities, this idea of weakening identity is becoming very powerful. So if you don't have money for the ticket to go to Europe and to study the set of mind, you can go to one of your universities and to see here more or less the same cultural trend. But universities, it's all the cultural trend. If you take society as a whole, you'll find out that in America, and America on one hand is one of the most religious countries of the free world. On the other hand, no doubt it's one of the most, if not the most free country of the free world. Why? Because the American Revolution was principally different than French Revolution. In French Revolution, which is the base of today's understanding of freedom in Europe, religion was the enemy from the very first day. Religion was the target. You had to destroy it. You had to create universal unity of French people who are united, who throw away their Catholicism, their Protestantism, their Jewishness. You remember Napoleonic code that you can be Jew at home but not in the street? And that was nature. That was how freedom was understood. In America, religion was a very important part of the struggle for freedom. Well, I give there some examples. I will mention briefly only one of them. If you look, the problem of veil. In Europe, it became the symbol of the struggle for assimilation and for equality. There are laws, one country after the other. First of all, France passed the law which doesn't permit to Muslim girl to go to public school with a veil. When in America, in one school, they tried to do the same, Supreme Court defended the girls. Why? Because here in America, freedom doesn't mean that you have to raise identities. Freedom means, yes, public space in Europe must be neutral. You should have no identities in the public space. Here, it must be shared. You can have all the identities as long as they are committed to freedom and democracy. But if not, the society has full right to fight against those who insist that their identity doesn't accept democracy. And it's interesting what happened in Europe, that on one hand, they try to play down identities. They try to prohibit people to go to school in veil, because they believe that maybe it will bring more equality and less tension. On the other hand, they are not ready to fight against those who don't accept the rules of democracy, because in accordance with the spirit of multiculturalism, they say every culture is equal and we cannot impose on them our values. And as a result, the cultures which accept democracy and the cultures which don't accept have the same rights. And that's wrong. The power of identity has to be framed by the power of freedom. And the freedom has to find its force in the identity of the people. If you go to the Middle East, and of course, 308 chapters of my book are about Middle East, I touch there three aspects. Identity of Israelis, which emerged from identity of Jewish people and how it is connected. Identity of Israel as a Jewish state. And by the way, I was very pleased to hear yesterday when Obama in his speech on AIPAC said that, insisted that Israel has the right to exist as a Jewish state. Why it is important? Well, it's, of course, President Bush was saying it, Senator McCain, Senator Obama, but in Europe, even our big supporters, today, I'm mumbling. Today, to say that they support Jewish state and not democratic state of all the citizens is political and non-correct. How it happened? It happened just because, well, on one hand, we have these enemies who want to destroy us, and that's why they want to deny the Jewish nature of our state. But on the other hand, there is this great liberal philosophy of universal values which says that national state is something what belongs to the past. And what we have as the result? We have the result that on one hand you have Palestinian leadership, which is strengthening their people every day in their identity, which is based, unfortunately, on hatred of Jews, but which has no obligations to democracy and freedom, and we are not insisting on it. But on the other hand, we have a society which has full obligation to democracy and freedom, but from which the world expects to stop being Jewish. It must be clear that every democratic state is the state of all the citizens. And of course, Israel is the state of all the citizens. And we can discuss this topic a lot. It's very interesting discussion, but I can tell you only one fact. And I was a minister of interior who is dealing with the citizenship. I met thousands and thousands of cases of Palestinians and Arabs who were ready to do everything to get Israeli citizenship. I didn't see one case when somebody wanted to give away his Israeli citizenship in order to get citizenship of any Arab country. It by itself, it says that Israel is the state of all its citizens, of course, with all the challenges which come out of this. But national state has a mission in this world. For example, France supports all over the world, France supports the courses of learning French. And it doesn't support courses of learning Italian or Arabic. And nobody expects from France to do it. When Iron Curtain fell down, Germany immediately came to the citizens of Soviet Union and said that everybody who is of German origin, even those whose great-great-great-grandfathers came 300 years ago, can get German citizenship. And nobody expected they'll say the same about 150 other nations of the former Soviet Union. That is the right of national state. That's the meaning of national state. And Israel has a much bigger challenge than this. It has a challenge to gather exiles after 1,000 years, to keep the language which was dead, the culture which disappeared, to keep it alive, to bring it back. And, of course, to defend itself against those who don't want the existence of Jewish state. So, for those who see the importance in the existence of the small island of freedom in that world of dictatorships, and in the small infidel country, non-Muslim country, in the ocean of Muslim world, have to understand that the only way to defend this state must have a strong identity. If it doesn't have a passion of history, of roots, of faith, of solidarity of your people, you will not have the strength to defend yourself. So the free world has to be interested that Jewish state will have, that Israel will have a strong identity in order to defend its freedom. Well, in the past, there is a famous story about Napoleon. Napoleon, on his way to Russia, he didn't yet know what expects him in Russia, but on his way he crossed through Poland, and in one of the shtetls, he saw in the local small synagogue of the shtetl, they are sitting old people, and they're crying and crying and crying that something terrible happened. And he asked, what happens? What happened in the city? They said, well, it's Tisha B'Av, that is the day when Jews are crying about destruction of their temple. And as the famous legend says, Napoleon said, the people who can cry about destruction of their temple 3,000 years ago will live forever. Now, even in my book also another story. This interview which Israeli journalists had with one former terrorist from Hamas. And this former terrorist told him when he understood that Israel can be destroyed. He said, I was in prison, and prison in Israel, it's a great school for training terrorists because, of course, our prison is not like the one in which I was. They sit together, they discuss together, they have their meetings, so. And he said, and one day, it was a Passover week, and I see that the guard is eating the bread. And I ask him, why are you eating the bread? Isn't it your holiday? He said, well, these stories of 2,000 years ago have no meaning for me. And he said, at that moment, I understood we should not agree on any compromises. We'll get everything, because the nation for which its history stopped speaking to, is doomed. We will destroy them. It's a very interesting comparison. You think these terrorists, Napoleon, came to the same conclusion, though from different sides. Well, of course, I am a big optimist about our nation, about our state, and about our people, because we proved again and again how much strength we have in fighting for universal ideas in our identity. But today it's also a challenge for all the world, for all the free world. Free world, which is in such a strong confrontation with terrorist fundamentalism, or with fundamentalist terrorism, whatever you want. Free world needs a sword and a shield. The sword, about this I was writing in my previous book, it is desire of people to be free. That is a very powerful weapon, appealing to the people of this, all the world to be free. The weapon which doesn't kill anybody, which appeals to very deep desire of people not to live in fear. But in this confrontation, this struggle with the fundamentalist and terrorist regimes, you need also a shield. And this shield is identity of the people. Of the people who know that there are things for which it is worth living, but there are things for which they are also ready to die. And I can tell you that I'm optimistic because I saw this union. Exactly a year ago, together with Václav Havel, the former president of Czechia, and Maria Aznar, the former president of Spain, we organized a conference, three of us, in Prague, which became like a big international conference of democratic dissidents from China and from Russia and from Libya and from Iran and from Iraq and from Palestinians were there and Lebanese and Sudanese, people of very different identities who were risking every day their freedom and sometimes their life, but people linked with belief in free society. And that is the union which we have to build. And free world, protected by the people with strong identities, can win the struggle with fundamentalism. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharansky, for that talk. Folks, we have some time for questions. We have people in the aisles. Please put your hand up. I will call on you. Wait for the microphone. And I would implore you to phrase your question as a question. Who would like to start us off? Gentleman back there in the white.
Yeah, you seem to be saying that these traditional group identities is a useful motivational device for fighting against the bad guys, because the bad guys also have a strong sense of identity. Is there anything else good about this traditional sense of identity? And secondly, if Europe is really as defenseless as you're saying it is, why hasn't it become a Muslim theocracy by now?
Well, well, first of all, if I can say anything good about identity except from the fact that it gives you strength to fight, very simple. Identity gives meaning to your life. So freedom is great because it gives you unique quality of life. But in addition to quality, you also need meaning. And meaning, what means your desire that your children will go on a certain way, your desire to feel yourself connected to a specific community. All the things which make your life bigger than your personal existence, it's meaning of life. It's a very important thing. So I wouldn't say that it's only we need identity because it protects us against bad guys. First of all, we need identity because it gives layers and layers of meaning to our life. But second, it's very important. There is inner function and external function. But second, yes, it helps us to protect freedom. Now, you know, if Europe will continue like this, thanks God it's not continuing because it's already is alarmed. It understands that something's going wrong. Already the idea of one universal Europe without identities becoming more and more problematic. But if it would continue as the last 30 years, it could become, but look, wait, it's only, there are hundreds of millions of Europeans, if you take Western Europe, 350, I insist on Western Europe, because in Eastern Europe, in fact, people understand it much better. They were under a totalitarian regime, they were under the regimes which tried to undermine their identities, so they do understand the importance of identity and the importance of resisting to dictators and not appeasing them. But even if you take only Western Europe, on one hand you have hundreds of millions of people. On the other hand, you have a few dozens of Muslims, and they already have such a problem. And already, by the way, by all statistics, I show some of that in my book, but there is a lot of statistics which shows how integration of Muslims in America which doesn't fight against whale and doesn't fight against identity. But in America, it's by far better integration than in Europe. So Europe, which made it so open, so easy to join, it put no demands. And now it finds out that they are not integrating. So if it will continue like this, and if there will be 150 million Arabs, of course, or Muslims, without obligation to democracy and without readiness of the society to fight, that they will become part of democratic society. Of course there is such a danger. But thanks God, I hope it will not happen.
Another question. Lady in red, about 6-7 back. You can wait for the mic.
Hello. It's an honor to be here and see you, sir. I remember when you crossed that bridge in 86. It was amazing. I have a question. I'd like to know, when you were in prison in Russia, did you have any kind of information or connection or anything at all about the freedom movement in America, all those postcards we signed and marches we attended, et cetera, for your release and other people's release that were in your position? Did you have any information at all? Thank you.
So if you were among those who were marching or who were sending me cards, first of all, I want to thank you. But second, I have to say I didn't receive any cards. But it was extremely important that they were sent because KGB received them. And KGB knew about the struggle. Of course, I knew very little. First of all, I was sure that the struggle takes place because I was, for a few years, like an official spokesman of our movement. I met with hundreds of the activists, and I was sure that they continue the struggle. I was sure that my wife and my friends and the State of Israel continue the struggle, whatever KGB says to me. And I had, in 9 years, I had two private meetings with my family. During these meetings, of course, they told me a lot, but it's two meetings in 9 years. Or sometimes when somebody is arrested and, let's say, later than you were arrested and he comes to prison, you meet him 2 years after he was arrested, he can tell you what was 2 years before. So it was also very meaningful. But when 99% of what was happening, I didn't know, but I could feel it. Because KGB, in each time there was confrontation, there was constant confrontation between me and KGB. In the last moment, they were not letting me to die. For example, I had a long hunger strike, insisting that they would permit me to write letters. For more than a year, I couldn't write even one letter. And I almost died in the last moment after 110 days. They retreated and permitted me. Like a year later, in the same prison, another dissident, Russian dissident Oleg Marchenko, had the same type of hunger strike, and he died. So I could feel that KGB is afraid, is scared, is under pressure. From this, I could understand that if KGB is under pressure, it means that there is a great and powerful movement of solidarity. And also, you know, as I quoted many times, KGB gave the great name to this movement. Once KGB told me, who you think will help you? Look at them. They are only a bunch of students and housewives. And we are KGB. So they were right. It was students and housewives. But it was the old Jewish movement of students and Jewish housewives, supported, of course, by many people of the free world, which destroyed KGB and Soviet Union.
Another question. Gentleman in the middle here. If you could wait for a mic, sir.
Thank you. Again, I'll just reiterate, it's an honor to have you come to speak to us. You were a hero to those 1970s type of activists. Thank you. Why is it that in recent years it appears that the government of Israel is so unwilling to defend itself? You've got these rocket attacks coming in from Gaza. You've got terrorist attacks. Why is the Israeli government laying down and letting its civilians get bombed, get these rocket attacks, get from Sderot? What's going on? What has changed in the mentality of the Israeli government in recent years? This is not the Israel of 1967. What has happened? Thank you.
Well, first of all, I want to tell you there are things which didn't change from 1967. We have the brilliant army. We have each time when there is, we are in danger, the level of voluntarism is unbelievable. The number of people who are coming from reserve to go to the army is bigger than the need always. And we have this strong feeling that we have to win this war. We don't have any other country. We don't have any other place to go from there. What changed? That's exactly what I'm discussing about. You know that even without resistance which we give to the terrorists, and I am the one who was in many meetings of our security cabinet when we had to take decisions about sending our troops against the centers of terror. And I know how all the time the issue of human life vis-a-vis the need to strike terror, how we are trying our best to be the most human army in the world. Nevertheless, we constantly are accused, not by our enemies from Muslim world, but from the leaders of the liberal world. We are constantly accused how we dare to fight, how we dare to kill innocent people in this world, in this free world, where there is no moral distinction between terrorists who are targeting civilians and whose success, the more civilians they kill, the more successful they are, and between the army who is targeting terrorists, who is trying to kill only terrorists even if he is in the middle of the crowd, but of course who often are killing also innocent civilians, when there is moral relativism, when there is no difference, when these terrorists and Israeli army are accused on the same moral ground, it is very difficult to fight, because after all, we are part of this free world. And that is the challenge, I believe, not only for us in Israel, to try to keep this very high standard of fighting, being on the front line of the struggle against terror and keeping yourself as a free state which respects human rights of everybody. It's also the challenge for the free world to understand that we are fighting, that we are on the front line of fighting also for them, for their interests. And we want them to apply to us the same criteria, not the same criteria which they are applying to the terrorist regimes, but the same criteria which they are applying to themselves, to America and to European countries. So everybody who can help us in this struggle is welcomed. Thank you.
Folks, we have time for a few more questions. Lady in red, back.
Framing it in the context of personal identity and national identity and so on, could you give your thoughts about a two-state coexistence of Israel and the Palestinian state? Is that feasible, etc.?
Well, first of all, about ideal situation. I believe that ideal situation could be if there were two states, both democratic, both strong identities, both respecting the right of one another to exist. As I was always saying, I want Palestinians to have all the rights that I have, except the right to destroy me. What means that peace, real peace, is possible only if it goes hand in hand with building civil society. Now, already for a couple of years, but definitely in the last year, more and more, practically almost all leading specialists in Israel on Palestinian society, on what's happening inside Palestinian society, say there is no leader there who is interested in two-state solution. And it's a very strange situation. We are talking to ourselves. We are trying to convince ourselves, let us agree with two-state solution when you don't have real partner on the other side. But the problem, there is a special chapter in my book about this. The problem is that two-state solution can succeed only if there are two civil societies who build their identity not on denying the other, not on fighting to kill the other, but who have positive identity. Positive identity through history, through desire to succeed together, through desire to live together. And by the way, if I could write identity for Palestinians, I can find many facts how to describe their positive identity. The problem is that for 50 or 60 years that Palestinian people exist as a people before there was no in such word as Palestinian people. But for these 50 or 60 years, all their leaders were trying to put this, to build this identity on one thing. The Jews have to be destroyed. Now that Hamas came, for them, Palestinian identity doesn't exist. For them, it exists only Muslim identity. And the message is the same. The only reason that you Palestinians are in this world is that you have to kill Jews. So the problem with our leaders and with the peace process, as it is called, peace process, and I don't think that it ever was a real peace process, that it was believed that you can have a peace process which is built on ignoring their democracy. And from the very beginning it was decided that it is good that Yasser Arafat is a dictator. About this I wrote a lot in my previous book. So it was decided that it is good that there will be dictatorship which will keep for us stability. And at the same time we need to decrease our identity. If you read the New Middle East and all the other good articles and books which were written at the time of Oslo, the idea was post-Zionism, that now we have to become the part of the big world. Let's finish with this nationalism. So on one hand, we are trying to create society without nationalism, but with strong belief in democracy. And on the other hand, we are trying to encourage them to have society which is based on identity of hatred, but without no obligation to democracy, to the contrary. And that's why it was impossible. So is it possible? Yes. But for this, our approach must be encouraging civil society among Palestinians. And there are Palestinians I am meeting almost every day, definitely every week, those who want to invest in building, Palestinians who want to invest in building civil society, who want to dismantle refugee camps, who want normal education, who want free economy, and so on one hand. On the other hand, of course, it needs emerging of the strong Palestinian leaders who really believe in freedom.
Well, we have time for one more question. The gentleman in blue and the tie.
I'm curious how you survived physically in the Gulag when I've read that the in the Soviet Union that they used some very extreme measures against dissidents, including things like microwave energy and different forms of psychological torture. You seem to have come out of this physically in pretty good shape. I'm wondering if you observed others who weren't as fortunate and may have been subject to some of these extreme measures using high technology techniques.
Well, first of all, yes, the Soviet Union, really, they were doing everything to destroy political prisoners. Say, about high technology technique, and I know some theories about it, Soviet Union didn't have high technology technique. Simply because they didn't have them. They had some high technology technique for espionage in America, but not in the Soviet political camps. In Soviet political camp, everything was very primitive. Yes, I went through torture punishing cell, which under the law you are not supposed to be kept 15 days. I was kept 405 days. And it is a real torture by hunger and cold. I have friends who went through the torture of psychiatric hospitals, where you don't need high technologies. You're simply giving them so-called medicine from which it's unbelievable pains on one hand and neutralization of your mental power on the other hand. And that's real awful, cruel torture through which many of my friends went through. Why? And of course I know many friends who went out of prison with destroyed health. I would say about myself, well, first of all, you can read my book, and my first book, Fear No Evil, where it's all prison memories. I describe almost day by day what is the how you're surviving in prison. And I have to say that here, two things were important. First of all, I'm sorry to say it, my identity. The fact that all the time, every day, I could put myself in much bigger context of historical struggle and to understand why I'm there, why I, in the punishing cell, in this absolute darkness, why I'm a free person and why I should not cooperate with them. The moment you make it rational, the moment you understand myself, why you have to go through this? You have a lot of strength to go through this. Well, I will not go to many angles. I'll tell only one thing. For example, I liked to play chess. It was my biggest hobby in my life. And thank God I could play chess without the board. So here in the punishing cell, I was playing thousands and thousands and thousands of games with myself. And I won all these games. And so they want to destroy you intellectually. They hope that in this punishing cell, after hundreds of days, you are absolutely, you don't understand what's happening to you. And I was, with each game, I was becoming stronger because I improved the previous game. So, and there are many other ways. But of course, the other thing was, what really destroys people is the lack of hope. And the hope I had, on one hand, because of my roots, on the other hand, because I was absolutely sure that people of the world are fighting for me, that it will never stop for a moment. So this your identity, which gives you strength and hope, that's what helps you to survive.
What an honor.
Okay.
Sharansky. And if you'd like to join us upstairs for the book signing, we'll see you up there. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.